As I mentioned, thinking about the book of James, and as we've gone through it recently, from 2008 or so to about 2012, during the financial recession or downturn, it's been labeled different ways. The book of James was somewhat in the back of my mind. I had gone through much of the New Testament during 2007 and 2008 and was seeing larger themes and trying to study details even. And as I was going through James and looking through several commentaries, I recognized just how practical this book is. At that time, I was sort of on a preaching schedule to do some other things. I think I was in several Old Testament books at that time, and so didn't stop to just do a study through it. But if there's an economic downturn again, and I can adjust, I certainly want to preach through it then, but hopefully even now it'll be helpful for us in thinking about it. In fact, I recognize the broad themes of James and the economic issues, and then when you get here to chapter 4, these internal issues. The progress of James, right away, James mentions the trials that come and God's generosity. James introduces God to his audience, if you will. Now, they certainly know God, but he sort of brings God on stage in the drama of James, if we can allow it to be somewhat of a story, that your God is generous. Yes, there's a trial, but God enters and he's generous to give wisdom to help you in this trial. And part of that wisdom is a perspective that he is the one who meets your needs, and therefore the very needs, as James 1 progresses, the needs of life, because God is so generous, those who are poor can actually rejoice, and those who would be wealthy would need to recognize that that stuff they have could be taken away very quickly. Beyond that, God is so generous to give new life, and this is sort of from the lesser to the greater in James 1. If God is generous to give wisdom in a particular trial, we could certainly trust him to do that. He would certainly do this smaller thing, because he gave us, by his own choice, new birth, James writes later in James 1. If he did that, if he made you his child, if he brought you in, certainly if he did that, he's going to give you wisdom along the way. In James 2, the situation of the church where if someone comes in who's wealthy, someone who comes in not looking as wealthy, what are the church leaders going to do? Are they going to give favor to the wealthy person, hoping that he can help the congregation along, hoping he can help them out? And James says, don't do that. You've become judges with evil motives. You're hypocritical. You're not trusting God. And along the way, James is not just concerned about the financial health of the church. He's concerned about its spiritual health and the fact that this judgment, this hypocrisy, this welcoming in the rich man and harming the poor man is just that. It's shaming the poor man. It's not just a financial misappropriation of God's ability to provide, the God who makes axe heads float. It's a discrimination at the human level. It's harming that person. It's not fulfilling the law of love, the royal law. Love your neighbor as yourself. James criticizes, I think in James 2, especially church leaders who are wanting to favor the wealthy, and along the way, discriminate against those who might not have as much. Seeing everything equal. Yes, look at people's lives and their faith demonstrated in their works. There's certainly no virtue just in poverty, but faithful living. And this brings us to James 3 that we looked at last week. Again, James taking on, I think, in many ways, church leaders here. It's the church leaders who would be speaking, and he says, let not many be teachers. And there's this zealotry idea in James 3 that's challenged. This taking on of outside opponents. Again, the group here has been displaced, and it may be that there's an unsettledness amongst them and an opportunity to go and take on those outside, to overthrow, to have perhaps gain some wealth for themselves. And this leads us to James 4 here. James 4 begins with this idea of criticizing others and these infightings and wars, and it made me think, again, about 2007, 8-ish to about 2012. And so I did a little bit of research, and I wanted to think about the way that financial pressure affects relationships. There's lots of studies I found that have been done on this, but I know just from my own life, when there are tight financial times, things can get a little hot in the relational spheres that I'm in. Maybe it's just around me, but I have a sense it's probably around others as well. If the budget's a bit tight, if there's demands here financially, do you notice that your fuse is a little shorter? Or maybe you just notice that other people's fuse is a little shorter, right? It's probably the case that if we looked in the mirror, it's us too, that I'm a little more ready to criticize when times are tight. Spent what? You did what? Don't you see that we have this? It's here where there can be some additional pressure involved. And just doing some research about articles and data from the financial crisis in the United States, 2007-08 to about 2012, one Indiana researcher looked at the level of domestic violence during the recession and how it increased. One Indiana researcher said that the financial crisis was, quote, fuel to the flame of domestic violence. And that is sad. But when times get tight, people can turn on one another, even in the family. I did some more research on this because I was thinking, I wonder what the stats are, and I didn't look exhaustively, but one paper from someone at the University of Maryland doing research found an interesting conclusion because I thought, well, I'm going to find out about divorce rates and the financial crisis, because certainly if domestic violence is on the rise, divorces probably are on the rise during that period as well. But one researcher found that it's actually the opposite. Divorce cases went down, and so this researcher tried to dig up, well, why? Why would domestic violence rise during a financial crisis, but divorce rates would actually go down? And one researcher found that it was because people couldn't afford to get a divorce. They would want out, some because of domestic violence or other reasons, but they had nowhere to go. So they just stuck with it. I'm not commenting on divorce or its rightness or wrongness or biblical perspectives or those kinds of things. I simply want to illustrate that during a financial crisis, it's not just our own situations, but across the board, people tend to come against one another. It's the pressure. And this is James 4. How might we foster church fellowship during those times? That's the question I want to ask this morning. During those times of pressure, be it financial or otherwise, how might we foster church fellowship? How might we, I'm asking, go against the grain? If the natural tendency during pressured times, financial or otherwise, is to be combative, to criticize, as James will say soon, how can we foster that? How can we not be combative but welcoming? How can we be people who are long-suffering? How can James 4 help us? Trials often reveal selfish, divisive inclinations, James will suggest in verses 1 through 4. So we need to humble ourselves before God. James 4, 5 through 10 would be a great passage to memorize. Yesterday and Friday night, we enjoyed the scriptorium. Many of us who were here and heard portions of Genesis, some Psalms, Isaiah, Ruth, Matthew, and just the Word over and over. I'm reminded again of the power of the memorized Word. And James 4, 5 through 10 will sit alongside that kind of an event in the goodness of God. It's there we can humble ourselves before God, see all that He has done for us, see His goodness from His Word, so that in these trials we look to Him, we rely upon Him, and we avoid criticizing our Christian brothers and sisters. Verses 11 and 12. The logic of James 4 is acknowledgement, verses 1 through 4, yes, trials cause these kinds of inclinations. Verses 5 through 10, solution. Look to God. Look to His goodness. Look to what He can do for you. Church, together, turn your eyes on Jesus. Seek first His kingdom, His righteousness, and then a straight admonition in the end. Don't criticize one another. You won't need to, because you'll see all that God has done for you. Join me then in the acknowledgement that James makes. Trials do bring divisive, selfish inclinations. Notice verses 1 through 4 with me. What's the source of wars and fights among you? Don't they come from the cravings that are at war within you? What kind of cravings might James have in mind? One of the things that we recognize when these broad statements in the New Testament come up, cravings, just any kind of an author writing about a selfish disposition in the audience, sometimes it's fairly general, but sometimes the author will move quite specific, fairly general in places like Colossians 3, Ephesians 4 and 5. Paul's pretty general in don't be selfish in the way you speak and act and so forth, because what God has done for you, rely on Him. James moves pretty specifically here. Verse 2, you desire and you do not have. And James, using hyperbole, similar to Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, a number of parallels with the Epistle to James, he says that they murder and covet and cannot obtain. For James, murdering is not just taking up an object to actually stop a person's heart from beating. It's an attitude of destruction towards someone in the community, likely because of jealousy or anger at them, and in this case, perhaps a financial kind of an idea. You murder and covet. Those two words are together. You want what's not yours that someone else might have. You want the blessing they have to be yours. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and you war. James is just stacking up the terms in verse 2. You do not have, he says, because you do not ask. In the midst of verse 2, James goes from this selfish description of what's going on to an implicit idea of prayer. It's likely that in the midst of need, what would a Christian want to do? Pray. So James, here in verse 2, that's assumed that that's happening. Do you see that? It's assumed that prayer is going on. You do not have it because you do not ask. You do not ask with, or you do not, rather, it's not going on. But then in verse 3, it progresses to that. You ask, once you recognize that, you ask, verse 3, and you don't receive because you ask wrongly, that you may spend it on your desires for pleasure. The crisis leads to prayer, James is hoping here, but then that doesn't seem to solve the problem. What James is getting at here is the quality of prayer. Not its quantity, but its quality, its motive. And here, it's to spend on your desires for pleasure. James calls this being, verse 4, an adulteress. Desire for pleasure in verse 3 is paralleled with what in verse 4? Friendship with the world. And that is paralleled with what? Hostility toward God. Desire for pleasure, friendship with the world, hostility toward God, God's enemy. Verse 4, last phrase, whoever wants to be the world's friend becomes God's enemy. I mentioned earlier that there's this fine line that financial security can provide us. It can meet our needs, all the rest, but there's a fine line where what we want is not just for the sake of meeting our needs generally and trying to be generous to others, as Paul would argue in Ephesians 4, but it's pleasure. It's more than necessary. It's what would just give us a sense of vain glory and being puffed up more than we need. This is where we become concerned about what other people think of us based upon what we have. Several years ago, I read an excellent article on discipleship and finances. The author argued that in this day and in this situation of the world, even during the recession, Christians in the West had so much wealth, comparatively speaking, around the world, and we can use wealth to shape image. We can use wealth to project an image of ourselves that we want other people to have of us. And that is some of what I think James is getting at. That's worldliness. That is seeking an identity in a thing, a label, a projection, and not in Jesus Christ. It's here we ask ourselves important questions. How much of what I own is really about Jesus Christ? How much of my square footage, how much of my vehicles, how much of my wardrobe, how much of everything I have is really about Him? Is it wrong to have what we have? No. We need a place to live. We want to be hospitable. We need things. You need clothes. You need to get new clothes. They wear out. You want to get something that looks nice. Your vehicle breaks down. You need to get a new one. You need to make an adjustment. But is there a case, and I ask myself as well, where I use those opportunities to spend, and I use whatever money I have for the sake of projection because I want to be thought about a certain way? James says, be careful. That is friendship with the world. That is being an enemy of God. David Platt says, as we focus on battling the world, a world system that encourages us to want more stuff, to prioritize our comforts, and to ignore the poor while we focus on ourselves, the adversary would like nothing more than to divide us so that we fight battles among ourselves and have little energy for the real battle that's going on. James 4 is about fellowship in the midst of this and folks who are maybe wanting to just see their identity not in the fellowship of the church. That's not their primary identity, but their primary identity is outside what they have, what they could earn, their image. Adulteresses, James says, friendship with the world is hostility toward God. He recognizes the problem, and here's the solution beginning in verse 5. Do you think it's without reason that the Scripture says that the Spirit He has caused to live in us yearns jealously? This is God's grace. He has put His Spirit in His people that they know when they've crossed the line. And you know this if you're a believer. You recognize when you cross the line from, okay, this is what I need, this is what is going to be solid for me in a sense of temporal security, okay, I'm meeting my needs. You know when you cross the line to image projection, to adulteresses, to friendship with the world, I want to be thought about a certain way. I am now master of my money because it not only provides me temporal security, it's now used to project an image about me. I'm this. I'm that. I live here. I own this. I have this. This is where the line is crossed. And if you're a believer in your heart, you know when that happens. Because the Spirit in us, He yearns for us. Come back. This is the Spirit's gentle whisper to us. You are putting your hope in something that's fleeting. You have God, the one who by His own will gave you new birth. You have Him. Stop playing with mud pies. Come eat at the king's table. Look at the next verse. He gives greater grace, verse 6. God's grace, God's presence is greater than that thing that could be sought, that identity, that title, that projection. You know it to be true. If you've walked with the Lord for very long, we all, ups and downs, you have gone after that title, that image, that projected thing, and you have found it to be a hollow idol. This has no real help for me. In fact, it makes my life worse. We use money we don't have to buy things we don't need to impress people we don't like, I heard it said. And what you get in the end is loneliness and discouragement. Verse 6, but God gives greater grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud. He gives grace to the humble. This is God's word to people who have much less than we have, who have fewer opportunities than we have. How would he speak to us? Christian in the West with all the opportunities to project image, to have wealth, pleasure, all of that. What are we living for? And James is going to get to the point in a moment of God's grace is better. And if we're befriending the world in this way, it's likely there's going to be criticism inside and there's going to be conflict. And we're going to miss God's goodness. Doug Moo says, God has a claim on us by virtue of His work in our lives. The scripture which James refers to in verse 5 could be any number of scriptures. If you just read, and just recently I read through Deuteronomy, if you're doing scripture story, I read through it, read the end of Deuteronomy, and what you find in Moses' sermons, especially Deuteronomy 30 onward, God is absolutely jealous for His people. He is the God who wants to meet their needs, and one day He will. He will circumcise their heart. He will make them sensitive to His word. This is His plan. He is a jealous God for us. He yearns for His people. Moo concludes, James here is reminding us that God's grace is completely adequate to meet the requirements imposed on us by that jealousy. Our God is a consuming fire. His demands for our exclusive allegiance may seem terrifying, but our God is also merciful, gracious, all-loving, willingly supplying all that we need to meet His all-encompassing demands. God is greater. God is greater than the things that we could pursue. God is greater. James is not saying if you need something, don't buy it. You need to do, we need to work to meet our needs, to get by with what we would need. But beyond that, there is a line that is entirely subjective, and all Christians of all ages need to be aware that that line can be crossed, and crossing that line is not just, oh, well, I'm just wanting to keep up with the Joneses. No, you're becoming a friend of the world. You're an enemy of God. You're making yourself master of your money, and that is a dangerous place to be because we are not. So quickly could it be wiped out. And beyond that, all that time we'd be missing out on greater grace. I can sit for too long, unfortunately, and recognize how many times and just ruminate how many times I have sought something that's empty and sought it with a lot of thought, planning, and it's led me to dissatisfaction. God gives greater grace. He's better. God resists the proud. He gives grace to you who humble yourselves. This is His goodness. So, verse 7, submit to God. That's the admonition. This is the solution. Submit to God. Seek Him. Pray with right motives, not to just spend on pleasure or projection, but for needs. Resists the devil, and here James introduces the devil and a situation of Satan alive and well, tempting, deceiving. The devil just is here in the garden. The devil logically working, you need to project this image of yourself because you're really not good enough. God hasn't done enough for you yet. God hasn't done enough for you, so you need to project this image. You need this thing. You need this neighborhood. You need this brand. Because God's grace, regeneration, the wisdom He promises, all the providence He's given, isn't quite enough for you to have the reputation you want with those outside. So build more, buy more, earn more, own more, project yourself. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he'll flee. Verse 8, draw near to God. In verse 2, you do not have because you do not ask. You're not going. And then when they did go, they were not asking with the right motives. Verse 8, James has moved through the whole scenario. Draw near to God in a humble heart. He'll draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, sinners. Purify your hearts. Be people of integrity. Stop being double-minded. James, the second time, brings up double-mindedness earlier in James 1. The double-minded are those who ask but don't think God's going to supply. Don't be like that. And this is a spiritual battle. The worldview class right now is reading through Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis. Every time I read Mere Christianity, I think, why? Why has it taken me so long? I've read it two or three times. Why has it taken me so long to get back to it? It's so good every time I go through. Lewis writes this, "What Satan put into the heads of our remote ancestors was the idea that they could be like gods, could set up on their own as if they had created themselves, be their own masters, invent some sort of happiness for themselves outside of God, apart from God. And out of that hopeless attempt has come nearly all that we call human history. Money, poverty, ambition, war, prostitution, class, empire, slavery, the long, terrible story of man trying to find something other than God which will make him happy. And he has not found it yet and won't. So we should stop and seek God." I was talking with one of my kids just last night a bit about the Lord and things in life and about the satisfaction I have found in God at times. And I think I've told this story once or twice over the years, maybe not. But when I was in college, I was converted in college, and I was in a fraternity at that time. I tell people, God has a sense of humor, converting someone in a fraternity. And so I'm in a fraternity, and God woke me up and gave me a vision to help the fraternity and to have influence there. So I ran for this position and was elected by the fraternity to be an educator of the new class coming in. So I was sort of their principal. I was in charge, make sure they went to school, had grades. You know, if they did something really stupid, I tried to get them out of it, you know, that kind of thing. And so this was my position. And one of the things that the class would each year do is go to another town, another college, to the same fraternity, stay overnight, and you know what would happen. Okay, it's just decadence. So this is what they did. So I drive, we order buses, we go down to KU here, the fraternity at KU, Lawrence, and so we're on the campus, everybody's settled in. And by this time, I've been on a bus with drunken men and all the trash, and it's about 9 p.m. by the time we got to Lawrence, and the fraternity was ready for us. And you could, you know, I'm amazed that more deaths don't happen at fraternities and more issues. I mean, you hear about it. It's God's grace that anyone survives. And all this is going on, and I'm a believer and I'm here. And there's loud music, just packed with people, hundreds of people in this building. I went and found a closet where I could read my Bible. I didn't want to be around anyone. I needed God. Now, a few years before that, if I'd have been in that situation, I wouldn't have been concerned about a Bible. Trust me. But when you taste and see that the Lord is good, the most near excusable pleasures seem like rotten food in comparison. Big weekend for us, Friday night scriptorium. Yesterday morning was here. I spoke at the scriptorium at a big day. Yesterday afternoon, been tired. Yesterday afternoon, girls were helping get some dinner ready. And I just found a quiet place in the house about 5 p.m. just to read my Bible. Because I still have not found anything